So, good. Welcome to another edition of the Social Computing, Social Gaming Lecture. As you might have, I don't know if you that are regularly present have registered that already, but the recording, unfortunately, of the last two sessions is out of order, right? And I really tried to reconstruct and repair the recordings with the help of Michael Petter, but unfortunately, for some reason, you don't know why, the recording is corrupted, right? So I run some tests, and I think today I rechecked the configuration. So as of today, I think it should be working again. If it's not, I'll try to re-record at least today's session. For the other sessions, I would like you to refer to last year's recordings, right? So it's easy to find them. They're on the same web page, and so you don't lose anything. It's more or less the same slides, same content, so should be a good replacement for the missing recordings, right? And I'm truly sorry about that, but I have no real idea what this was about. We tried to check everything, but now it works again, so some magic appearing there, okay? Good. So as of today, we've been dealing with social network analysis quite a while, and what we've seen so far is we looked at measures for centrality in terms of edges and nodes, and it's clear that this is an important form of analysis of long-term social context. Who's important? That could be used for marketing, for games purposes, for a lot of things. And in the last slide set and in the last lectures, we've been dealing with finding dense sub-graph structures as models for groups, and particularly cliques and plexes and clans and some of their algorithmic properties. Okay. Now, we said that is fundamentally different in terms of taking those prototypes as models for groups from doing clustering, right? So the prototypes are distinct subgraphs that fulfill certain definitions, while today and in the next session we'll be dealing with a more data mining based approach for finding groups of all sorts. And today we'll be looking at graph clustering, so clustering in this discrete math space of graphs, right? So next session will be about metric spaces, okay? And there we will briefly touch upon machine learning fundamentals, so because modern social computing is basically a lot about machine learning, and I'll give you some basic insights about that. Now, well, as of today, that's that, and today we'll be looking at graph clustering techniques, right? So what we already discussed was that paradigm of, well, density, or the paradigm of finding dense substructures of whatever sort, it's that what you want to optimize is the intra-cluster coherence. So within your groups, your clusters, your dense substructures, the density should be as high as possible, whereas within the structures, between the structures, the density should be as low as possible. In some sense, that needs to be formalized in the upcoming slides, right? So within the group, there's a lot of coherence. Between the groups, there is a lot of decoherence. And that's what we always want to optimize, ideally both at the same time. And, well, without using those fixed schemes of the last slide set, how can we come up with subgraphs that will fulfill this paradigm, or in other words, that would optimize this criterion or those two criteria? The technique would be graph clustering to actually do it, right? And still, the downside of it is that the predefined structures have clearly defined properties. So with a clique, we know it's perfectly dense, perfectly compact. We pretty much know all of its properties. And we can be really sure that within a friendship graph or something, a clique does really represent some socially relevant structure. Whereas clustering, you might have come across clustering in your course of study up to now, is something that's always controlled by parameters, right? And those parameters are really elastic. They would allow you to put an emphasis on larger clusters, denser clusters, less dense clusters, spherical clusters, elongated clusters, whatever, right? And you just can't be sure that what you actually find is something that has a truth to it, a social truth, for example. And these things, these structures that don't have this social truth to them, we call quasi-groups, right? So if you would just do data mining in a social scape and a scope, and why, for example, with respect to body hate, right? You might find some clusters there, but they're, in most cases, not really socially meaningful, right? And you'd have to be very aware of what you do there. Nevertheless, it really depends on what you want to do with those clusters. So I already gave you some examples of applications. So one application from our research domain is investigating influence, topical influence in social media, for example, or if you would like to have it in games, right? And it is plausible to state that influence from within your group is stronger than from outside actors. This could really be readily transferred to dense structures found by clustering if you set the parameters right. So it's always, it depends on what you want to do, right? So basically, from a machine learning perspective, clustering is a so-called unsupervised learning technique, right? So what you're trying to do, as in data mining, or in some parts of data mining, you would like to find structures that are inherent in the data without providing an external ground truth, right? And that is the difference to supervised learning, which is typically classification. Because what you will have there is you would train this supervised learning system, for example, the classifier, with a set of training data. And the training data is data that has class labels in the case of classification, or in the case of other, it has some sort of labels. Right? For example, in the case of regression, when you don't want to learn class labels, but instead want to map X values to Y values, you also train the system using a set of pairs of X and Y values. Right? So the Y values can be interpreted as class labels in case of classification, or as just what they are mathematically, the Y values as in case of regression. But both are supervised techniques in terms of that you'd have a ground truth and you would just want to train the system such that it is able to predict a class label or a Y value for an unseen pattern X, right? So typical classifier would, for example, be able to distinguish tables from chairs, right? And what you would give the system is training data in the form of hundreds of tables and hundreds of chairs, and then you would like to classify it a previously unseen object. For example, this dustbin. Is it more like a chair or more like a table? Right? And then the system will decide based on its internal model structures, right? And in artificial intelligence and data mining these days, keyword is big data and all of its shades and tastes, there's a lot of applications. For example, text classification or whatever, other classification sorts. And for example, the guys at Professor van der Smacht's team, what they do is robot hands and trying to teach it how to grip things. So this involves a lot of regression problems to be solved, and that's typically done, with supervised techniques. So for us, we're more in the unsupervised realm. So meaning that we have a social network, and what we want to find is groups in the network, right? And this is, we don't have any training data. So there's no external knowledge coming from some sociologist saying that this and this and this forms a group, right? If you had these data, you could also apply supervised techniques, but usually we don't have them. What we will usually have for clustering, not necessarily restricted to the social computing case, is that we will work in metric spaces, right? So we have a mathematical metric. We know what a distance is in those spaces, for example, an R3 or some vector space, whatever. And then we can apply techniques such as k-means clustering, fuzzy c-means clustering, Gaussian mixture models, all of that. But here, in our discrete case, the only information we have is this discrete graph structure. And we have path lengths, but that's not a true distance, right? There are techniques working with path lengths, but we don't have a metric space in general, right? Some notations that we will use throughout this lecture, right? So we will usually start with a directed weighted graph, meaning that we'd have a weight mapping from the edges to the real numbers. And a graph clustering, which we will try to compute, is just a partition of the set of nodes into these clusters C1 to CK. And this clustering is then written with a boldface C. The edges that run from one cluster to another are denoted as E of CI, CJ. The edges that are just within the clusters are denoted with E of C. And the set of edges that run from one cluster to another, whatever, are denoted as E of C bar, right? So these are just the edges that are not running within the clusters, but somehow from one cluster to another, to a node in another cluster, right? The number of such edges is denoted as M of C or M bar of C. Again, we'd have the notation of the induced subgraph. So if you have one of these clusters, obviously it's a subset of the set of nodes which induces a graph, right? If you just take all of the incident edges together with that. There are three special clusterings that have names, right? If the clustering has only one cluster, which is trivial, so the whole graph is one cluster, we call this the one clustering. And a clustering with V many clusters is a clustering of singletons, right? So each node is in its own cluster. And these are, in some sense, trivial because they don't convey any information. Another one that's important for us is a clustering where you just split the set of nodes in halves, and that's called a cut, right? This is just a notation, so A of G is the set of all, that's why it's called A, all possible clusterings on graphs. This will be used for denoting mappings later on. If we have two clusterings, we say that one is a refinement of the other if there is some I, if for all I there exists a J such that this I is, cluster I is contained in cluster J, right? So the notions of refinement and the inverse notion of coarsening is very intuitive, right? So you get finer or coarser. Finer, the more divisions you make. Coarser, the more clusters you fuse or the less classes you have, right? Clusters you have. A chain is a comparable set of clusterings. So this is a hierarchy, right? A hierarchy can range from the singletons to the one clustering and everything in between, and this we will call a dendrogram later on, right? So this is a whole hierarchy of splitting the set of nodes of the graphs into ever more finer clusters until you arrive at the singleton clusters. And how you do this splitting, so this dendrogram is some sort of global cluster structure of the graph that you can, well, split at any level you like. And this is very convenient, right? So such a dendrogram is total if both of the trivial clusterings are contained. A hierarchy that contains one clustering for each of that is called complete. And what will be important for us, a cut function just takes a graph, can be a graph that is induced by a cluster or anything else, and cuts the set of nodes into halves. So a cut function produces a cut, right? Or suggests a cut, if you want. And in essence, it maps the power space of V to the power space of V just by saying that I have the set of nodes, and usually it's V, and then it suggests one half, because the other half is then trivial, right? Because that would be just V minus that one. Good. So, in order to formalize the clustering paradigm, what we need is some sort of quality measure, or in other words, a measure of how well the clustering paradigm is fulfilled. And this then corresponds to an optimization problem in the end. So that's what clustering can always be formulated as, namely a optimization problem. Okay, so a quality measure is such an objective function that takes a clustering and maps it to the real numbers, such that for each clustering in that set of possible clusterings, we would have one numerical value modeling the quality of that clustering. As always, the weight function is interpreted as some sort of similarity between the nodes. We can also have negative weights if we want and interpret them as dissimilarity, but usually it's a better idea to map the weights to the range 0 to 1. So in that way, we can distinguish between the case where there is no edge between two nodes or and the case where there's an edge, but the edge has a weight 0. And the total number of weights of some set of edges is just adding up the weights of the constituents of that set. So, having said that, going back to the ideas of the first slide, our usual measure will be that this index consists of two factors, namely F and C, right? Where S is a submeasure that formalizes the intra-cluster density or coherence, whereas G is a measure for the inter-cluster sparseness or the inter-cluster decoherence. And you would want to maximize both at the same time, right? That's why you add them. You could also multiply them, but obviously adding has some nicer properties. And in the denominator, you would have some sort of reference quantity, right? So that this index then becomes gets to lie in the range of 0 and 1, right? But what's the problem with this denominator? Can anybody see a problem at this point? Seems to be reasonable. I mean, if you say F plus G, and well, the normalizing constant should be the maximum that you can get. Well, obviously the problem is clustering is an optimization problem. And in order to know the denominator, you would have a global, you would have to have computed a global solution to your problem already, because that's what you're seeking. You're seeking the clustering that maximizes F plus G. And if you already had that, there is no point in dealing with the index anymore. So in, this is like an ideal formulation. So in most cases, we don't do a normalization at all, or we divide, let's say, by some combinatoric quantity, such as the number of pairs v square or something, right? So just have that in mind, that it's somehow a bit contradictory. That's just the basic definition. So, well, first quality measure, first idea, right? Why not leave G aside at the moment and just concentrate on F? Once again, F is the intra-cluster coherence. And how can we measure that? We can just add up the weights of the edges that lie within the clusters. If we are able to maximize that, we would maximize intra-cluster coherence. Bam. Yeah? And this is a possible such a weight. So we take the weights of the intra-cluster edges, that's the numerator here, and divide it by the denominator, which is the weight of all the edges in the graph. So we get a perfect, nice relative measure. Everything is fine. So G is zero, and we can try to optimize that. But there are a few downsides. So obviously, there is some maximum value, and when does that maximum value occur? If you take the trivial one clustering, because then everything is within the only existing cluster. So that's not very meaningful, right? Furthermore, we also have such a coverage, and that's the name of this thing, such a coverage value of one if the set of intercluster edges, or the weights of those, if the set is the empty set, or if the weights are have a total weight of zero. That's another case, but won't occur in practice, right? And, well, if you regard this property here, you would have already intuitively grasped this one. So if I have a certain clustering, I can always get better by fusing clusters. So we have a monotonous behavior, and this is not very ideal for an optimization approach, because the optimization approach would then always converge at the one clustering, because I can always get better by fusing clusters. And so the optimal non-trivial clustering would then be a minimum cut, right? But in essence, if you can get better by merging two clusters, this is not very ideal. So we can really not make use of this. So the first idea would already be dismissed, right? Second attempt, yeah? Obviously, what is desirable as a case is that we have some subgraph here and another subgraph here, and only very few edges running from one to another, right? So if this is our whole graph, the whole thing together, it's clear that if I make a cut here, it's a good clustering, right? Because I'm cutting across very few intercluster edges. Okay, so the idea would then be to define a measure of, well, how this structure is qualitatively realized, and we would call such a cut that cuts across few intercluster edges a bottleneck, right? Or you could say the graph itself has the property of being bottlenecky. Right? It's like you can easily break it apart into two halves. That gives rise to a measure that we call conductance, right? And that's defined here, right? So another way to look at this is that clusters should be well connected within themselves, right? And this measure for bottlenecks is defined as such. So these are special cases that we can safely forget for the moment, because the bottleneckiness is one if we have a cut where one half is the empty set, right? So what I do is I take the graph and say, this is my one half, and the zero set is the other half, right? This is not really very meaningful, and that's why this gets the extreme value of 1. And the other case, the extreme value of 0 is taken if there are no inter-cluster edges at all. So that is the case if the graph just falls apart into two components. Then it's very easy to make a perfect cut in that sense, because I don't cut across anything. Right? This is the second extreme case. So what we already see is that the smaller this conductance phi of a clustering, of a cut, to be more precise, is, the smaller phi is, the more bottlenecky is the clustering. Right? And a clustering is bottlenecky if it cuts across very few intercluster edges. So a reasonable way to formulate this would be just to count all the weights of the edges that are cut by the cut, right? To add them up. And the normalization here would be a pessimistic normalization by taking the minimum of these two quantities here, right? And these two quantities formalize, if I take one half of the cut, namely, let's say, this part here of the graph, and cut how many edges are run from the structure itself to the whole set of nodes, right? So counting everything that's in between and everything that runs into the other structure, all of these things are counted, right? And in essence, well, these run from C1 to V or from C2 to V. And I take the minimum of these two, which makes it a pessimistic normalization in the sense of I'm rather cautious, right? I could also take the maximum. But in the end, this is the quantity that counts. So the number or the weights on the intercluster edges, okay? Well, obviously, I drew some here that are not yet, that don't exist, right? Because I said these are the only ones, so I would have to restrict it to those, right? But you know what I mean. So this is certainly not correct in that example. However, good. The conductance of a graph, then, is defined as the minimum of phi over all possible cuts, right? So I have my graph, and then I investigate, can I cut it here? This would give rise to one value of phi, or would I cut it here? This would give rise to a second value, and so on. And I take the minimum that I can get, right? So this is the conductance of a whole graph. So a graph with a small conductance suggests that a good cut is possible, okay? And we'd have this theorem that states if we are, for the moment, looking at an undirected and positively weighted graph, we'd have the maximum conductance of phi equal to 1 if and only if the graph is connected and has at most 3 nodes or is a star. So these are basically the cases where the graph is connected and has at most 3 nodes, and that's a typical star. Okay? So in order to understand that, let's just investigate the opposite direction of the proof, right? So if and only if means that we have a bijection, a bi-implication. So let's just check this direction here, right? So if the graph is connected and has at most 3 nodes or is a star, then the conductance is 1, just to get a feeling for this formula, right? So obviously, so this is the conductance here, right? This is our phi for if we have a non-trivial case. And looking at the denominators, we can see that the edges that run from one cluster to the rest of the set of nodes can be written as the weights that run within the cluster. So everything that runs here in the cluster plus the weights of the edges that run across the clusters, right? And these we have denoted by this. So having this insight, we can write the whole definition for the conductance in a more handy form, namely that W of E bar is divided by W of E bar plus the minimum of the weights within cluster 1 and within cluster 2. Now, if you investigate any of these structures, you can't make a cut where this quantity is unequal to zero. So for any of these things, a star or at most three nodes, it's clear that the weights that run within a cluster would always be zero, right? So within here, I can cut, for example, here, but there is no edges running within either these two nodes or within these, right? So there's just no edges that would run in this one half, right? The other one has edges, but we're supposed to take the minimum here, okay? And the same is true here. I can cut here or here or here. You just, one of these quantities is always zero. So that's why the whole expression gets one, right? So what does that tell us? In a sense, that tells us that these are prototypical graph structures that don't lend themselves well for being cut into clusters. Yeah? So the star would be like an ego network, you and your friends, right? And without explicitly also modeling the relations between your friends, right? This would be like a star-shaped network. And in such a star-shaped network, this is a typical ego point of view, there is no sense in trying to come up with a division into a half, right? And the same is true for a triangle relation, yeah, or for a binary relation, because there is not much going on in the halves, right? Or in one of the halves, at least. So these are, in a sense, typically non-divisible graphs, right? Good. Now, obviously, this doesn't have the drawbacks of coverage because it doesn't have this monotonous behavior. It's good. But as with all these things that are good modeling-wise, it's always hard to compute them, right? So calculating maximum conductance is NP-hard. This is a bad news, but we can approximate this with a so-called guarantee. That means that if the guarantee factor, that is in O of a square root of log of the number of nodes, this guarantee factor says that the true solution will not be farther away from the approximated solution by multiplied by that factor. Okay, and we can see that the logarithm of the number of nodes is something that is really well behaved. So even for Facebook, it's in the order of magnitude of, I don't know, 8, 9. You name it, right? And the square root would even be smaller. So we know that the maximum conductance is only an order of magnitude of 2 or 3 away on even very large social networks. The conductance of a clique is around 0.5. depending on the precise number, depending on whether the number of nodes is even or odd, but you can see these fractions are very close to one half. Okay? So we can see that a clique is not something that, in contrast to a star, for example, the clique can be cut, but it's around 0.5, so you just cannot say that a clique is especially bottlenecky or not. It's just in the middle, in a certain sense, right? So You can cut a clique in halves. Remember that a clique is nested. So you and your father are as good as a family as your mother and your sister, right? But in a sense, well, where you cut it, so cutting it along father, mother, brother, sister, or the other direction doesn't really matter, right? So there is no true suggestion that the graph structure induces. Good. Now, having defined conductance, we can define two appropriate quality measures on the basis of conductance. So the first one would again be a measure where we would have G equal to zero and F as just as the minimum of the conductance values of each of the clusterings. Okay? Why is that? Okay, so if all of the clusterings have mediocre conductance values, it means that neither of them is really very bottlenecky. If one of them has a really low conductance, and conductance can be taken seriously as in the sense of German Leitfähigkeit, right? Electrical conductance. So if the graph looks like this, right, with those very few intercluster edges, we know that the conductance is very small. It is very good for a cut. So the minimum is also small. And that means if this measure F is small, that it's the case that at least one of the clusters has such a structure and can and should be cut in half. So the clustering is still two cores, and we need to refine it by splitting apart one of the clusters. Good. Yes. The second measure is just the other way round. So if we set F equal to zero and for G, for this intercluster decoherence, we set 1 minus the maximum of the conductance of any of the cuts in the graph, any of the cuts induced by a cluster, right? So each cluster induces a cut of the whole graph, and we just take 1 minus the maximum. Now, if this measure is small, what we find then is that at least one of those CIs has too many connections to the outside. So it's not separated enough. It's not isolated enough. So that means that since when this is the case, the clustering is too fine. We need to coarsen it up to an extent where the clusters don't have these many connections anymore to the outside, right? So if I have a very well connected graph here that is very well connected and I cut it in half, right? In the attempt of making the clustering better, I fail because each of those nodes in here has a lot of connections to the outside, meaning that this, where I introduce this cut here, makes the clustering too fine. I should have left it at the present state, right? So leave that cluster alone. Don't cut it further, right? And well, this is then a suitable measure for this case, right? So, that were these conductance-based measures, but they're more simpler ones, right? So, one idea is, why not take this idea of maximizing intra-cluster coherence and inter-cluster decoherence at the same time? Why not take it very simply and say that an edge is correctly classified by the clustering if it runs within a cluster, and we, as a tendency, we have made a mistake if some edge is between a cluster, right? So a clustering then introduces a classification on the edges, and this classification suggests an edge is correctly classified if it's within, and not correctly classified if it runs between the clusters or any two clusters. So you just count these things. Yeah? So F counts the number of correctly classified edges that run within clusters, right? And G counts all the edges that are not existent and that would have run between the clusters. Okay? So, once again, an edge is correctly classified if it's within a cluster. We understand that. If it runs from one cluster to another, it's incorrectly classified. But there is a third possibility, namely that there are two pairs of nodes. So, this is correctly classified. Yeah? This is incorrectly classified. Yeah? But another correctly classified edge is this case. So there are two nodes, but they are in different clusters, but they're not connected by an edge, right? So this can also be viewed as, well, we've done it okay. Yeah? And this is what G actually formalizes. Yeah? So I average over all possible pairs in the graph and say if they're not connected by an edge and they are in different clusters, I would also count them as, yes, we've done the right thing. Okay? And again, we're using Iverson notation with these square brackets, making every counting a 1 for each bracket when the corresponding logical expression inside the bracket evaluates to true. Okay? So this is that. Now, this is just counting edges, but it doesn't say anything about the weights, right? So, coming up with a weighted version of F is trivial, right? Because a weighted version of F would just correspond to something like this. But we will have to make up our minds what a weighted version for G will look like. But we'll get to this in a second, right? Now, going back to this case where we would just count, right? So this precise notation here. What can we say about the algorithmic properties of performance? So once again, it is... It follows the intuition, it's okay as a model, but calculating the maximum is again NP hard. Okay? So the whole measure would then be, well, obviously what we have here is we count pairs of nodes, right? Here by just counting the corresponding edges, and here we explicitly count pairs, right? So to get something that's in the range of 0 and 1, all we need to do is to normalize by the possible number of pairs that are in the graph, right? So then we get a measure that's within 0 and 1, okay? Now, there is some problems with this just counting correctly classified edges. So there's problems with that, and the tendency is that performance delivers many small clusters, right? So taking this example, so the graph is denoted here with these gray nodes and the corresponding edges. The upper image shows the result of performance-based clustering, and it falls apart into very many small clusters, while the two bottom images show possibilities for something that we might call an intuitive clustering, right? So if you were to intuitively cluster the graph, you might have come up with either this solution here or even this solution. But maybe for some applications this tendency is desirable, maybe for others it is not. Good. So this is the version I've shown you for weighted graphs. So for F, I said it's easy. We just have to replace counting the correctly classified intra-cluster edges by the summed up weights of these intra-cluster edges. That's clear. But what about these other things here? So the G counts those edges as correctly classified that are made up of two nodes that are actually not at all connected by an edge. Okay, but since they're not connected by an edge, first thing is, what weight should these non-existent edges have? It's hard, because you need to assign them a weight, because you're comparing, in essence, with an F that's also weight-based, right? And the second aspect that we have is, with this definition, what we completely ignore is these non-correctly classified edges, right? Because we just want to optimize those that are correctly classified. And those are completely ignored, right? And that's not very nice. So for the first problem, what we can say is that we can just multiply this whole Iverson expression here with the maximum weight, right? So that's a very pessimistic one. So we assume that each correctly classified non-existing edge would be of maximum weight. Well, certainly you're introducing a large bias towards G by that definition. That's not very cool. The other idea would then be to not neglect the intercluster edges that are there, right? But this would be denoted there, or their accumulated weight would be denoted as W E bar, right? If you just add up the weights of all the intercluster edges. But since you want to maximize G, what we need to have is we need to subtract this quantity from M times the number of these, right? If we would just take this here, this is a quantity that we want to minimize. But minimizing this means maximizing max minus this. Yeah? This is just another way of putting this. And this quantity here we call GW. And then we can assign this second factor here, or this second factor, an individual weight, so that we'd have a parameterized index over there, right? So this would then be a weighted version of performance, right? Where you take into consideration all of these things. So if you have some sort, or happen to have some sort of density measure on a graph, and we'll see what this is in the next lecture, another possibility to build indices is by using those density measures directly. So these density measures directly formalize the intra-cluster coherence, for example, as in this case. Now, you can be pessimistic by stating that I take all my clusters, compute their density with whatever density measure, we'll see that, and then we take the minimum. And that's certainly a worst case or pessimistic scenario, where the quality of the whole clustering is determined by the quality of its worst cluster in terms of density, right? Always having the intra-cluster coherence as the only measure in this case. And naturally, you can come up with the average case or the optimal, optimistic best case, where you take the maximum, right? Now, this is especially suitable in metric spaces where, for example, for the density, if we have a mapping of the graph into some metric space where the weights correspond to distances, yeah, we can take centroid values or something. So there's a lot of ways to come up with these things in metric spaces. Good. Now, we've seen a lot of measures, but what we don't know yet is a way to actually do the optimization. Now, having modeled your intuition in terms of a quality measure, you can pretty much use all of the optimization techniques that are out there, right? And one particularly simple optimization technique is greedy optimization, right? So the basic idea of greedy optimization is, well, follow the gradient, at least in a metric space, right? So we're not here in a metric space, but this is always the image that you draw. So if you have some space and there is some target function here on that space, and you have a solution for your problem and you want to find a better solution, all you do is you follow the gradient, right? So steepest ascent until you arrive at some local or even global optimum, right? And this is precisely, this is precisely what is denoted here. And this is a algorithm for greedy minimization. Just if you want to have greedy maximization, you just need to replace some of the inequality signs, right? Now, what we start with is such a feasible solution to our problem, which is that point on the hat. And this feasible solution we call L0, and then we iterate, right? And this says, while in the neighborhood of my current solution, there is a solution that's better, meaning where the costs are less than my current solution or any other one that I take into consideration in my neighborhood, I say I'll take the one with the least cost if I want to do minimization. So for minimization, you can draw the same picture, basically, but then you would have to have such a dip, right? Something like that, and you have your solution, and you have the neighborhood of that solution. All of these can be taken into account, and you would choose the one with the minimal cost or the minimal index, right? If you want to minimize, that's just the same picture here, right? And it's called greedy because it greedily sucks in the quality and says, I want to get better, I want to get better, where's the better, where's the better? Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it has the tendency to end up in a local optimum, obviously, right? And there's ways to counteract that, classical simulated annealing or something, where you would spread your attention to larger possibilities. So typically, if you want to prepare for the social computing exam, your brain tells you, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it, I would just want to go out and drink beer or something, right? But you know that at least for some of you, that's a required course. You need to get through this valley to end up at an even better optimum without social computing, but maybe with a bachelor's degree or a master's degree in some brave new world in like 10 years with a lot of money and a golden retriever and so on. So that's why you take up the burden of learning all of this. And this is, well, some of you might be tempted to follow the path of greedy optimization and always go out to the Wiesn and so on, and then they don't pass the exam, and that's not a good idea, right? Good. And these values or the functions that we use are precisely our cluster quality measures that model the clustering paradigm, right? Good. Now the question is, so these images here on the blackboard are typical images of functions on the real two-dimensional plane, right? And this is a metric space, and that's what we don't have here because we work on graphs, right? Now the question would then be, if I have a clustering on the graph, how would I construct my neighborhood, right? What are the next best clusterings to take into account? And what we can do is we can take two of our clusters and merge them, or we can take one cluster and split it. So that's the coarsening or the refinement direction. And that is more or less what we have as a neighborhood, having one clustering and wanting to get to another one. Now, is this the only way to transform a given clustering? Of course not. What you can do is you can exchange single nodes, or you can do other operations. And those of you that had already something to do with genetic algorithms might hear a little or feel a little tickle in their backs, because that's precisely what you have. So you have the solution that's somehow encoded, and then you exchange some parts of the code and check whether this gives a better solution. And that's just what nature does. So you have your local mutations of the genome, and the resulting organisms either die out quickly, or they would have a higher reproductional value, and then they survive and the new mutation is in the world. Right? That's how evolution works. Sadly, it has only produced beings as that, and not better ones, but maybe this comes up in future times. So we will concentrate on merging and splitting for the moment. Now, merging and splitting would just precisely deliver those things that I talked about in the beginning, namely the dendrograms, right? So you can either start with the singleton clusters, so putting each node into a separate cluster, and then start merging until you arrive at the other trivial clustering, namely the one clustering. Or you can take the one clustering and start splitting it until you arrive at the singletons. You don't necessarily have to start at the extremes or have to end at the extremes, so you can also start somewhere in the middle and end somewhere, but this is basically what you can do in that realm of dendrograms and splitting and merging, right? And the nice thing is that the whole dendrogram of the whole graph is a global clustering structure that you can cut at any desired level. Because one of the basic aspects in clustering is always how many clusters do I want? Yeah. So if I look at Facebook, I don't know how many users are there, like 10 billion, I don't know, something like, no, not 10 billion, obviously not, but like 1 billion, let's say. It's 1 billion people on Facebook. And the question is, what is a suitable number of clusters there? 100, 500, 10 million, 5? So usually you don't know that. And so in order to come up, you need to do, well, a lot of runs. You need to do, for example, cross-testing. You need to run several of indices in parallel, one for the number of clusters and the other one for the actual clustering, and so on. However, if you have a dendrogram, you could, if you knew the number of clusters, you could practically cut it at any level. Yeah, for here, for example, we have a 4-cluster level in that and another 4-cluster in that. Okay. Now, oops, sorry. Now, two more words. So if you start by coarsening the one clustering, or no, if you start with the singleton clustering and ever coarsening your clusterings by merging clusters, this is called agglomerative clustering or linkage. Whereas if you start with one clustering and start splitting, this is called divisive clustering or splitting-based clustering, right? And this is basically what linkage does. So we start with a weighted graph and some initial clustering. And the next question that we just need to answer is, of all the clusters in that clustering, we need to assign one pair that we want to merge. So which two clusters do we want to merge? That's the question in linkage. And in order to do that, we have two possibilities. So first possibility, we have a global cost measure that says how good a certain clustering is, right? And we had a lot of these already, like performance, for example. And of course, you take that pair of clusters where the resulting global index is undergoes the most improvements, or the most improvement by that merging, right? So if the global index improves by 2,000, if you take the first two clusters, and only improves by 10, if you take the fourth and the 17th, it's clear that you should take the first two candidates, right? Second idea would be you have a local cost measure, where for each pair you have something like a local improvement or a local cost, right? So that would be the other side of viewing things. You want to keep costs low, or you want to improve your measure as much as possible. And there is two famous such algorithms and corresponding local cost measures. One of them is called single link clustering or single linkage, and the other one is called complete linkage. And basically what you always take into consideration is the distance, the path distance, between any two nodes in the corresponding clusters. And single linkage is most optimistic because it says that two clusters, the distance between two clusters is defined as the minimal distance between any two nodes in those two clusters. And complete linkage is maximally pessimistic by stating that the distance between those two clusters in question is determined by the maximum distance of any two nodes. Right? And that's how these things are defined. Okay. Now, let's look at the respective algorithm, and we won't need to read all that I just put on these slides for reference. Let's take an example. And by the example, I think we'll understand how single linkage and complete linkage work algorithmically. Right? So, first of all, what we need to construct are so-called threshold graphs. Okay, and that's very easy. So, if you take this adjacency or weight matrix that's depicted up here, we know that, for example, the edge from node V2 to node V1 carries a weight of 9. Okay, and whatever this one here, so the edge from V2 to V3 has a weight of 6. And that's a symmetric matrix. For the moment, we'll only regard undirected graphs, right? And then you set a threshold, and you start decreasing the threshold. That's just by having a landscape of mountains, and you fill it with water, and then you decrease the water level, and then certain mountaintops begin to appear. And the same is true here. So you start with infinity, and then you start with the... So having infinity as a threshold means that no edge is above infinity. So in this threshold graph, no edge appears, right? Then you start taking the maximum weight, which in this case is 9, and then we only have one edge appearing there, because only this edge is larger or equal in weight to the current threshold. And then you start lowering the threshold, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, and so on, and ever more edges begin to appear, okay? Now, the idea, and this again is depicted here in the right half, right? These are just those threshold graphs. No clustering done yet. Now, single link clustering corresponds to the following procedure. So, obviously it's linkage, meaning that we start from the singletons. So, we start from this G infinity. And each node is a cluster of itself. In single link clustering, we would determine the clusters that are merged by the situation that they are just from one step to another form a new component, so that they just become linked. That's why the algorithm is called single linkage. So the moment that a single link appears between two clusters, making them from two separate components into one connected component, then we take this as a new cluster. So this is the merging step. So let's look at this, right? So here we have 5 clusters. Now this is the first merging step, because that is two components now become connected by an edge. So that's why in the corresponding dendrogram, node V1 and V2 are connected. Second step, in this threshold graph, 0 and 3 start to be connected. again, bam, we readily join them. So that's the next merge. And then this edge appears, which makes this cluster with only the four and this cluster with one and two a connected new component. So that's the next link that we establish, right? And when in the next step this one appears, this edge appears, we would have a single connected component and we'll do the last join, the last merge, right? And that's how single link clustering works. And that's a very optimistic, very greedy, very fast way of merging clusters. Now, complete link is just the opposite, in that it works as such. So in single link clustering, the only situation where we merge two clusters is if they were cliques before, and in that new step, or they were cliques in some earlier step, single clusters and cliques, and in the step in question, they become one new clique. That's why it's called complete link. So you need to have all the links, whereas in single link clustering, it suffices to have one link, right? And if we go through that, what happens? So for complete link clustering, we start with the singletons again. And, well, one and two are joined because the graph with only a single node is technically a clique, and this duet here is also a clique. So before, these were cliques. Now in the new step, they form a new clique. That's why we're having this link here, right? It's the same is true for 0 and 3, so this one here, yeah? Now, in the next step, we get this joint here. No, we don't get this joint. So, of course not. Why? Because, I mean, this is a clique, 1 and 2, but this, how should I call this? 3-node graph here, this connected one, is certainly not a clique, right? So, this one here certainly doesn't appear in that step. It also doesn't appear in that step. What about this step here? So a triangle is a clique, right? But, it is a clique, but it's not made up out of cliques that were clusters before, right? Because the clusters that we had were 1 and 2 and 0 and 3, but not 1 and 3 or 3 and 4 or 4 and 1. So this triangle is a cluster, but it's not a cluster made up of previous clusters, yeah? And this is only the case in this step here, because 0 and 3 and 4, they were clusters before, and now the new thing that appears by introducing this edge is a triangle, namely this one here, and this gives rise to that joining or this merging operation. And you'd have to continue until the very end where everything is connected with anything else when you go down with the threshold to 0, and then only then you can do the last join or the last merge, right? That's why complete link clustering has its name, because it requires all the links, right? So in order to understand the connection to this local cost, all we need to do is to convert our weight matrix into a distance matrix, for example, by taking the inverse or just ordering the weights such that they are now demarked distances and not similarities. And then if you run through the same algorithms, right, you would exactly see that in complete linkage, you take the maximum distance between any two candidate clusters to be merged as a criterion whether to merge it or not, and the minimum distance for those candidate clusters as a local cost measure in single link clustering. Just play it through and you will see that this is the case, right? Now, these were all merging-based algorithms. Now, what about splitting-based algorithms? So the difficulty with splitting is, so while merging is simple, right? So you have your clusters, and the only thing that you need to face is what kind of two clusters do I need to merge? Yeah? But merging is a discrete operation. However, if you want to split something, if you want to refine it, it's not only the task to find the cluster which to split, but also where to split. Yeah? It's not clear. All right? So while in merging we had two cases, a global cost function and a local cost function, here we have four cases. First case, we have a global cost function. So this is our quality index for the whole graph. And what we just do is we compute the index or the C local before we split somewhere and then after. And we accept only the split where this becomes best, globally best. Second thing is just local, right? So we take, again, a local splitting cost or a local improvement, if you want, whatever it formalizes. And there are also semi-global and semi-local versions where we still have our local and global measure, but we have some cut function assisting us in choosing the respective cut, right? So, well, in the step from I to I plus 1, we split those that either yield minimum global cost or have minimum local splitting cost, or where global cost or local splitting cost is optimal according to the cut function that we have as an assistance, so to speak, right? So this here is strictly global, whereas this is strictly local, and these things we call semi-global and semi-local. And if you wonder why a cut function maps from the power set of the set of nodes to the power set of the set of nodes, it's just this is one of the clusters and this is one half of the split. So if I have my cluster, the cut function says this is the cluster I'm taking as my initial part of the mapping, and by introducing the cut I only have to specify this half because the other half is already clear, right? That's why these things map from PV to PV, right? This is precisely that. Now, how are those cut functions constructed? Well, a lot of possibilities there, right? So, certainly, what we can do, we can take the minimum argument with respect to V prime of all the resulting inter-edges, right? So if I want to split this thing here, what I just count is all the weights of the edges that run across the cutting surface or line, right? And I would take into consideration all such possible cuts and take the result as the minimum V prime, so the minimum one half. And you can normalize this by the number of nodes or by the minimum here, or you can use conductance as a measure to define cuts, right? So the minimum with respect to V prime of the conductance, which is just the maximum of this 1 minus here. And if you compare this, this is actually on slide 15. This is precisely what we had here. Precisely this thing here, right? 1 minus the maximum of the conductance. Yeah? This is what we had before. Okay. Good. So these are possibilities to just define those cut functions to give you an idea. Now, other options. So remember what I told you in terms of these genetic algorithms. So instead of merging and splitting, what you can do is you can exchange nodes from the clusters, so, or you can move one node from one cluster to another, right? Or you can take out a node and move it into its own singleton cluster, or, well, move exchange cluster assignments. Beware. Good. And if you do that, this is called shifting. Okay, and the respective algorithm would just choose from the neighborhood of a current solution according to possible shifting operations, right? And, well, whatever you choose corresponds to several possibilities. So you can use so-called potential functions, or you can do random selection, or you can use such a genetic algorithm-based approach with populations and using those exchanging and moving operations as mutation operators. Right? Good. So that's maybe that. Now, this we will do here now as the last thing of this slide set. Okay. All of these methods, and there are a lot more out in the literature, work more or less well. But there is some critique, obviously. And remember our lecture on centrality, where I introduced to you a paper by Mark Newman where he used this electrical analogy and the random walk-based equivalent analogy to conquer some critiques that are present with max flow betweenness and shortest path betweenness centralities, right? And now a new method by him and one of his colleagues, the Newman-Gerwin method, also conquers a critique, namely that many of the other methods fail to cluster peripheral nodes correctly, right? And that's what the Newman-Gerwin method really does well. And they've tested the whole thing on real-world networks and came to the conclusion that not only them, but other authors as well, that this is a really good group and community detection algorithm. That's why we investigate it, right? So this is one of the quasi-standards that are out there, right? It's rather simple, right? So in order to calculate the dendrogram, what they do is they calculate the edge betweenness for all edges, and then they keep on removing edges with the highest edge betweenness, just iterating over that, continuously removing those edges that have the highest edge betweenness centrality, right? So if you have the edge that has the globally highest betweenness centrality and you take it away, this node is so important, so central, because it separated two parts of the graph, right? So if you have a situation like this, right, and this is the edge with the maximum edge betweenness centrality, if you take it away, bam, this is the best split you can make, right? So and if you iterate that, then your dendrogram top down is constructed according to the clustering structure inherent in the graph with respect to edge betweenness. Well, that's nice. Now, the resulting thing would, for example, be such a dendrogram. The only thing that is left to do is to decide what is the actual level where we want to cut the dendrogram. So what's the number of clusters that we actually want to find? Now, this can be according to some external heuristic, but in the ideal case, the graph itself tells us what the best number of clusters is. So we need to come up with a measure, and that measure is depicted on the far right side, that would tell us where to cut it. And this measure, in this case, is called modularity. right? And that's why the whole approach is also called modularity-based clustering. And we can see that if we're lucky, and this one has a global maximum here for this spot, we would cut the dendrogram precisely where the modularity is highest. Now, what is this modularity computed like, right? So, first of all, which between the centrality can we take? We can take shortest path between the centrality, would be nice. Yeah, we can also take Newman's electric network based or random walk based between the centralities, whatever comes in handy, right? However, this is just for constructing the dendrogram. What about the modularity measure? So, if we have a clustering, we would have the situation as in this image here, right? Now, all you need to do is you need to come up with a matrix, and in that matrix, you count the number of clusters that run from cluster I to cluster J, right? Relative to the whole number of edges, right? So if you have 15 edges in the whole graph, and two of them run from node from cluster 1 to cluster 2, E12 would be 2/15, 2/15, right? So the fraction of edges between the clusters or between the communities. And that's this matrix E. So if you take the trace of this matrix, what you have is just the intra-cluster edges, the number of edges that are within clusters that run from cluster I to cluster I. And you sum them up, that's just the trace operation of the matrix. Okay? And the whole idea is to restrict yourself to this intra-cluster coherence. And what you want is you want to compare the intra-cluster coherence of the true graph, the true social network that you're investigating, with a possible random version of it, which would just retain the fraction of edges that connect to some cluster, right? So you compare the true situation with some fictionous random version of the graph that would just retain some basic properties. Yeah, that's the basic idea. And, well, what we need to see is that if we sum over the rows of this matrix, what we get is the fraction of edges that are connected to the cluster CI, right? So we have the whole graph, and we have one of the clusters, and what you do is, what are edges that connect to this cluster? Well, a lot of them. And you just sum that up, okay? And these things, these AI, are the properties that we want to conserve when we compute the random version or some fictionist random version, right? So, in such a random network where we keep all the AIs fixed, what is the probability of running from some node in cluster I to some other node in cluster J, right? So this is certainly proportional to the number of edges. Well, this is our node, our cluster I, and this is our cluster J, right? So the probability of starting here and arriving somewhere here is certainly proportional to the number of possibilities that I have to go out from my starting cluster, multiplied by the number of possibilities that I have to arrive somewhere in my target cluster, right? So it's proportional to AI times AJ. It's even equal to AI times AJ, if you think of this, right? So, in our random graph, we also want to only put an emphasis on the intra-cluster coherence, that is E random II, and this is AI squared. So basically, modularity is just EII of the true graph minus the EII of the random graph, which is just AI squared. And you sum that up over all clusters. And that is precisely comparing the intra-cluster coherence of the true graph with this fictionless version of the graph where we would just retain those AI as basic properties. Because otherwise, what would you like to compare it to? Yeah. So you have to somehow retain some basic comparable quantities, otherwise it would be like a total random foreign graph that you compare it to, which would also be possible, but this is like a more reasonable approach in this case, right? And that's basically it. That's modularity. That's the formula that just gives this function, and where this is maximized, right? So where the true graphs, yeah, the clustering on the true graph produces a as high as possible difference between the clustering on the true graph compared to this random graph, then we're on the safe side. Because then we do something really non-random with our original clustering. So the original clustering then really reflects something real, something that's there, right? Compared to any random consideration that we might have. Okay? And that's just that. If you would like to have it with a different derivation, this is a slightly more fine-grained derivation, right? Which takes individual nodes into consideration. But what we will see is that we would precisely get the same formula out of this, right? So if you like to do the probability calculations on the level of single nodes, then this is the way to arrive at, right? So the fraction of edges within the clusters, which was our EII previously, is given by that expression where Aij is just our adjacency weight matrix. Okay? You have to sum over all pairs of nodes, and only if they're in different clusters, right? Then we would have, if they're in the same cluster, that is this delta, right? If they're in the same cluster, then we would count their weights. So this is the intra-cluster edge weight, the accumulated one here in the numerator, and we set this into proportion to the overall weight of the graph, which we will denote as 2m, right? And if you make this notion, you would have 1 over 2m times this expression. And delta, this is a typical notation. Delta is 1 if the two quantities in question are the same, and 0 otherwise. So if you have this on indices, for example, something like delta ij, then this is 1 if I is equal to j, and 0 if I is not equal to j. In our case, we have ci and cj, which is 1 if the clusters are the same, and 0 in any other case. Yeah. So this is just to formalize that. And in the random graph, again, so we had this image here, right? And I said to you, what's the probability of starting somewhere here to arrive somewhere here? Right, but that was on the level of whole clusters. If you now take this more precise look and say, I'm at this particular node and I want to know the probability to arrive at this particular node, right? You have the same consideration. So the probability of going out of this node is proportional to its degree ki. Now we denominate this node as I and not as the whole cluster. And the possibility, the number of possibilities, the probability of arriving at this node j is proportional to kj. And the whole probability is just the product. Right? And this is the case for this random graph. And we also have to, in order to arrive at a real probability, obviously we have to take 2m squared in the denominator. And this is the resulting modularity. So the intra-cluster weights of the true graph together with the optimal, assumed optimal clustering minus what you would get in case for the random graph. Right? And this, again, evaluates exactly to the same expression as before if you take the respective correspondences. Bam. That's that. Now, we had this expression here, which is the simpler one, and this expression here, slightly more complicated derivation, but basically the same results. And our main source for this part of the lecture, which is again a chapter in the Green Network Analysis book, there is a different notion for modularity where we don't keep the AI fixed, right? So this would be comparing the true graph's clustering to a fictionless clustering on a random graph without keeping these global parameters fixed, right? And then this is easy because this is the intra-cluster edges on the true graph's clustering minus, just the number of combinations that are possible to form pairs in that random graph, right? This is just that version. And for this more fine-grained one, you'd also have a variant which you can try to interpret given this derivation, right? And then again, we're done with this part of the lecture. Now, important, tomorrow what we will do is we will discuss the exercise, yeah? And the exercise will be a lot easier than this, right? So this is already quite abstract. Some of you have already this drowsy looks in their eyes. Oh, yes, IJ, yes, go die. Okay, good. I know this. So it gets its life if you just take it step by step and try to review this at home, right? Now, exercise will be much easier, and tomorrow morning, Christoph will introduce you to the exercise. Again, you can improve the mark of the exam by 100%, basically, right? So the mark that you get for the exercise, freiwillige benotete Midterm-Leistung, will count, if you want to do that, will count the same as the mark of the exam. Yeah. So I'll invite all of you, and especially those listening out at their devices at home, to join. You don't need to come tomorrow to do the exercise. It's just we will introduce you to the exercise. You can still don't come tomorrow and do the exercise anyway, but I recommend you to come to see what we actually plan to do. And you'll see it's way more simple than these Newman-Girvan things. Yeah? So see you, hopefully see you tomorrow.